Og så er der filmnoter.
Velkommen til Filmnoter, der i dag har fokus på den roste dokumentariske folkemordsfilm The Act of Killing med et interview med filmens instruktør Joshua Oppenheimer. Mit navn er Morten Weilgaard Just, og jeg er din vært. Det sker en gang, måske to gange om året, hvis man er heldig, at man får en af de her filmoplevelser, som er noget helt særligt, som står ud og som bliver ved en, og som man ikke lige kan ryste af sig med det samme. Det skete for mig i 2012, hvor jeg havde en af de her oplevelser. Det havde jeg med den dansk producerede The Act of Killing af instruktør Joshua Oppenheimer. Jeg så den på Copenhagen Docs, og siden har filmen taget sin sejrsgang verden over. Den var publikumsfavorit på Berlinalen for et år siden. Sidenhen har den toppet alle kritikerlister som en af årets allerbedste film i 2013. Og nu er den endelig blevet nomineret og stor favorit til at vinde en Oscar her i Oscarshowet 2014. Det er en helt usædvanlig film, der nu er kommet på DVD. Både en biografversion og en director's cut version på samme DVD-skive. Den handler om et glemt folkemord i Indonesien i 60'erne, hvor over 1 million såkaldte kommunister, eller det var i hvert fald det styret kaldte deres fjender som samlebetegnelse, kommunister, som blev myrdet i midt-60'erne. Og det, der er helt specielt ved den her film, det er, at de her folkemordere, de er blevet ved magten. Man kan forestille sig, hvis Adolf Hitler og nazisterne, de havde vundet 2. verdenskrig, de var blevet ved magten, og at de havde fået lov til at skrive historien. Det er det, der er sket her i Indonesien, hvor Joshua Oppenheimer igennem 7 år har fulgt en gruppe af de her folkemordere fra dengang, som er blevet ved magten. De kalder sig gangster eller frie mænd, og det siger de med den største positive, nærmest en pralende facon. De er enormt stolte af de gerninger fra dengang, fordi de er jo vinderne, og de bliver ligesom nødt til at holde den her facade oppe. Og det er en helt forfærdelig film, og det er også en forfærdelig god film, som Joshua Oppenheimer har præsteret her, hvor vi følger gerningsmændene og deres historie. Det er ikke ofrene, men det er de her vindere, og dem her, der har skrevet historien, de får lov til at rekonstruere deres mord og deres horrible gerninger fra dengang. Og nogle af dem påvirker det slet ikke, og andre af dem kommer igennem en eller anden form for renselsesproces. Og det er virkelig en utrolig film. Og personligt for mig var det min bedste filmoplevelse det år. Hvis man er mere interesseret i filmen, så kan man købe den hos filmens producenter på www.final-cut.dk. Der kan man købe DVD'en. Journalisterne Bjørn Andersen og Jeppe Mørk har talt med instruktør Joshua Oppenheimer om hans tilgang til at arbejde med de her folkemordere, og hvordan hele den her proces den var. Så lad os høre det interview.
I think that I came into the project knowing that everybody I'm working with from my crew, but of course the people I'm filming are human beings. That was the first rule. And I always had to feel and treat them as human beings, and they are. So Anwar Kongo does many terrible things and says many terrible things, but he's also charming and funny, and I think that's something that was talked a lot about in Copenhagen too. But it meant that I could connect to him as a human being and hold on to that connection while making the film and through making the film. I didn't have to lie to them per se, I just couldn't show them that I was horrified by some of the things they said. So when I first met Anwar and his friends, and indeed the 40 killers I filmed with before I met Anwar, they assumed that I was on their side because I am an American, and they were working closely with the American consulate throughout the killings. They knew the Americans were supporting what they did. And anybody with the resources to come and go from North Sumatra is always on the side of power, or at least they assumed that. And so I could ask them very direct questions like, how did you kill, how did you torture, how did you exterminate the people in this village? Because words like kill, torture, and exterminate were the words they were using, as though these words had some kind of heroic connotation. And so I could talk very openly about what I wanted to hear about, what I wanted to understand, what did the killing of this man mean to you, for example. And they would answer me very openly, and so long as I kept hold of Anwar's humanity and tried to treat him as a human being, despite the fact that I couldn't be open about, at least early on, I couldn't be open about my own pain in witnessing and listening to these awful stories, I became very close to him. And I'm still close to him. And interestingly, the children of victims in Indonesia who see the film feel close to him. That the daughter of the head of the Indonesian Communist Party, who was the first, he was the first victim in the genocide, or among the very first. The whole family was exiled, the ones who survived. This is a woman who lost her statehood, lost her family, lost her father, lost everything. She lives in France now. She watched the act of killing, and she's been writing me every 2 weeks, how's Anwar? I mean, I never imagined that the film would be so, would help bridge that gap between survivor and between human being and human being, and dissolve the boundaries between victim and perpetrator without losing any of its moral clarity, because I think it's absolutely clear that the film is saying genocide is the worst evil that human beings can commit, and these people have done the worst evil that human beings can commit. It's been wonderful that the film is able to bridge that gap, and I think that I've become close to Anwar, the audience has become close to Anwar, becomes close to Anwar, and in the process, it was difficult because, of course, there was this pain because he's telling horrible things. I can't show how frightening they are to me, so they're haunting me. They're giving me nightmares. They're giving me insomnia. For 6 months or so, I really wasn't sleeping. I had real, like, would sleep one night a week. It was awful. And at the same time, the fact that I like parts of Anwar and am close to Anwar it kept me going. It made it possible for me to sit with him and be with him. And then, of course, there was a crew that was all going through the same thing, and we supported each other.
Another thing about your method is that you stage the participants to reenact these killings from the 60s. So it seems like you do not see a dichotomy between reality and staging. How do you see that?
Yeah, well, I think that all of our reality is always staged. Even right now, the way you're interviewing me, there are certain codes and conventions, almost unmemorized scripts that you're acting out, and I'm doing the same as I try and answer you coherently, even though I'm very tired and may not be my best today. That's part of reality. Reality is, and if you give me a 100-kroner note, I don't throw it away or put my chewing gum in it, because we have a shared story about that piece of paper, a shared fantasy or story. So our reality is made up of stories and made up of scripts. Then as a filmmaker, I believe the moment I don't really see myself as a documentary filmmaker per se. I see myself as a nonfiction filmmaker. I'm in pursuit of truth. And I think in observational documentary, very often we are creating a reality with our characters in which we pretend we're not present, or we pretend we're not influencing the things we are filming. I think if we're not filming a sporting event or a political rally or wildlife, we are influencing the things we're filming. So I believe that every time you film anybody, you're actually creating reality with that person. Why not create the reality which offers the most truth? That is to say, the most insight into the questions you're trying to understand. And here, I'm trying to understand how a whole society, and in particular its founding fathers, its perpetrators, has built a normality on the basis of celebrating genocide and on the basis of terror and lies. And when Anwar is the 41st perpetrator I filmed. The first 40 are boastful. They're just like Anwar. They're boastful, they're showing off. And I'm asking myself, up until I meet Anwar, How do these men see me? How do they possibly think it's appropriate to show off about how they murdered people for me? How do they see me? How do they think I see them? How do they want me to see them? How do they want the rest of their society to see them? How do they want the whole world to see them? And how do they really see themselves? And these questions of the are questions of the imagination, of how these men imagine themselves, especially how do they live with what they've done. And I came to realize that if I just let them do what they're already doing, which is to show off, and let them make the show off in whatever way they think is most appropriate, I will get and document the process and use the scenes that they create, I would get the answers to these questions. I would get the answers to these questions of how they see themselves and how they want to be seen.
But isn't there a problem in this staging method? Then the killers might be able to say that this is just your perception of the truth. It's not the real truth of what happened. It's just the way you see it, because you have it's you as a filmmaker who have staged everything.
No, I think that's a really important question, and I'm glad you ask it. They're staging it, and we see them staging it. And we see the process whereby they stage it. So you don't just see in the act of killing reenactments directed by me. In fact, I don't direct the reenactments. At the most, I create spaces in which they improvise, but we see them improvising and we see them talking about what they're reflecting on their improvisations and to planning the next improvisation. So the viewer, I think, of the viewer of the act of killing is in no doubt that what they're watching is are stagings by the killers of their actions and of their feelings about their actions, because they stage their nightmares and their fantasies of heaven and so forth, by the killers themselves, directed by the killers, written by the killers, played by the killers. The perpetrators in the film, Anwar and his friends, do everything. They write the scripts, they play themselves, and they play their victims, and they direct each other.
Your movie focuses a lot on absurdities, and you stayed in Indonesia for was it more than 7 years? What was the most absurd thing you witnessed in Indonesia, and was that in the film?
I think the most absurd thing I witnessed in Indonesia is in the film, and I think it's the talk show. That Indonesian state television produces a show, the title of which is Movie Theater Gangsters Reminisce, like happy memories, about the extermination of the communists by making a film. And they celebrate genocide on TV. I think one of the things you could say I did is to create conditions and where these men would take off their masks. And I don't mean that they were wearing masks prior to this. I think they've always been boasting about what they did. But somehow, by giving them the chance to stage it, they created these absurd metaphors for the immorality of a whole society built by and ruled over by killers. So the talk show became this metaphor for everything that's awful about this society that's not normally acknowledged. Same with the waterfall scene, where Anwar has this vision of heaven in which his victims give him a medal and thank him for killing them and sending them to heaven. We had a screening here in Berlin, 170 Indonesians came to watch the film, and they were laughing uproariously at these absurd moments, and I think it was a really cathartic and joyful laughter. And I don't think it's because the characters look silly. I think it's because finally, for once and for all, the truth has been that everybody knew to be the case has been exposed. It's like the Hans Christian Andersen story, that the king's new clothes. In comes the boy and says, look, the king's naked. And it's delightful for everybody who's been afraid, who's been intimidated and afraid and unable to say the king is naked, because now it's been said. And it's been said in such a clear, undeniable, absurdly clear, undeniable way that it reveals the absurdity of everybody going around and pretending that it's the king's wearing a beautiful suit of clothes while he's completely naked. So the film has this, I think the film works with this absurdity, and for Indonesian viewers, the absurdity is absolutely delicious.
Denne Act of Filmradio blev tilrettelagt af Morten Weilgaard Just. Kontakt redaktionen på filmnoter@den2radio.dk eller find os på facebook.com/filmnoter. På genhør.